I'm going to actually try to do this extremely fairly, even though I'm answering questions myself. So I see three people right away. Need your third, because you're always first. Please. And why doesn't everybody introduce say who they are? That'd be nice to have people introduce themselves. Okay, so I see, yeah, the four people, I have it somebody to write down on that.
Hi, my name is Eileen DeFrancesco. I have, I'd like to just mention something about evolution of the brain and ask you how and if you think it relates to karmic causation, tame and untame. In thinking of evolution of the...
Are people hearing adequately? Yeah. Good.
Primate brain, actually from the reptilian brain through the mammalian brain to the non-human primate brain and the primate brain. If we go back to the reptilian brain, that step to the mammalian brain, if we take that transitional being, a platypus type thing, and think about the action that caused the change, it really was something like one being taking care of another being, because we know that reptiles don't do that. They don't care for their young, they don't care for each other. And what allowed for the development of the mammalian brain really was this thing called bonding. And so, to me, it does support Buddhism and the causation, that action of, and if we keep going, ultimately we get to altruism and other things that do support Buddhism. But so it's, you know, in neuroscience we say, well, we don't know what happened first, the neuronal development that allowed for that bonding or that action of one being caring for another being. I just want to know your comment.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we have this picture of mammalian development, which clearly depends, and Darwin is clear about this, and Hume. We know that Darwin read Hume's Inquiry Concerning Principles of Morals. So the idea of nature red tooth and claw is not Darwin's. Darwin is clear that proto-moral social emotions are human and part of the ancestral mammalian lineages. So the question was something about, we know that reptiles don't care for their young. Some birds sort of do. You get interesting differences among ancient species, but at least in the mammalian lineages, you do get care of young. So that seems to be selected for, I think we would say from a Darwinian point of view. I wasn't sure whatever there is did evolve according to the Darwinian theory of evolution. So whatever dispositional traits we have species-wide, let's just take basic emotions, like the five or six or seven, depending on your scale. Those are part of our mammalian heritage, not uniquely human in terms of caring for the young and so on. So the orthodox Darwinian view would have to be, or is, that they arose through a complex set of genetic mutations that made a species do better than certain competitors. And once society and culture kick in, all kinds of enhancements could be done. But I'm not sure how that would have anything to do with untamed karmic causation. The tame karmic causation would, at least on my view, serve to explain why once human social groups started to form, we'll take just humans, we started to come up with creative ideas to enhance our what I call our proto-moral equipment to make us even better caretakers and hopefully more compassionate, generous, loving, and so on. But that's not doing as well as we hope sometimes. But we are socially creative, and we have all kinds of enhancement techniques to do this. But so I guess our Darwinian nature, as it were, because it's not red tooth and claw, fits beautifully with Buddhist ethics. But because Buddhist ethics says we have a very selfish side, watch out for it. Darwin says that, And like Hume, he says, we also have a compassionate fellow feeling side. Enhance that. One way to enhance that leads to certain political practices. Hume famously said, give me an environment without scarcity, like Shangri-La, and benevolence will increase tenfold, and the cautious, jealous virtue of justice will never be thought of. I think he's wrong about that, because sexual jealousy will still exist, but there's these enhancements. So yeah, karma causation tame, no problem. Untame, I just don't see. Yeah, thank you. Okay, my visual system has, see, this is the problem with my calling. There was someone in the middle there who went next. Yes, sir, yep, and then I'm going over there and then to Teed. That's the first four. In a minute, I'll ask other people to raise their hands. Okay.
Thanks very much. My name is Ted Arnold. Thanks for inviting us down here, Chris. I'm from Namgyal Monastery.
Great.
I won't be able to answer any of these things the way Alan and Jinpa certainly would, but I'd like to offer a couple of suggestions about your reading. And I'd like to thank you for reading His Holiness so closely, but I think you overread him a bit in relation to untamed karmic causation, particularly in relation to Tantra, which is very big in Tibetan Buddhism. I think you'll find some ideas there that would be probably more in line with what you want to see, that wouldn't be that kind of untamed wild. Because I think when you're reading the idea of future or sentience in a future tense, I think you're reading it as though it's something separate from the being here, the sentience here, when in fact it's a continuity. So I think that maybe a couple of words that you're grabbing onto could be read better by Alan or Jinpa in light of that. And I wonder, I was thinking when you were talking about the Theravadan tradition, and George Dreyfus could help us with this, whether the idea of immaterial consciousness, whether that's necessarily has to be the case, and whether perhaps Dharmakirti posited that or found it necessary to posit that in relation to materialist schools that were very dogmatic about whether or not Buddhism might be possible, and Roger Jackson, of course, could discuss this as well, is whether the very early schools believe that Buddhism or enlightenment or liberation involved necessarily the snuffing out of the individual, and so in a material sense, that's what you'd get. And so to posit Buddhism being worthwhile at all, you would have to have some sort of ongoing property, which would be consciousness. So that may not be as necessary as we would think it, and specifically related to the dualistic aspects. Again, going back to Tantra, you have that dualism that you suggested might not be as radical as maybe other dualisms would be. I think there, and again, Alan Wallace could certainly fill us in on that, Jinpa and so forth, that dualism really disappears, and maybe what you're referring to with physicists is where there's a level of subtle matter, subtle energy, where I'm certainly not qualified to talk on it, but they would be, that sort of dualism is completely different than any of us could really try to formulate here, but would require a lot of discussion and really pinpointing of words, understanding that's been done over the last 20 years, but I think maybe that needs to be discussed a bit more. Thanks.
I'll just thank you very much for the comment. This is exactly what's going to go on here. So I will give just thank the speaker because, yes, what's going on here is a lot of interpretation of very complicated text traditions. And just like any other tradition, there's all sorts of moves that go back to 500 BC to the early in the Common Era, where the way you put it is just nice. I mean, there were what we would nowadays call reductive materialists, even those naturalists among us say, well, you know, there was a group. They quietly have silenced themselves, good friends of some of us in the room, called eliminative materialists. And actually, Francis Crick, I read in the New York Times, his last interview before he died, he said in 100 years, we'll no longer talk about persons. Now, I just think that that's false for a lot of reasons. But a limited materialist sometimes would thought that certain words or ways of speaking will go the way of phlogiston, you know, in witches, belief, desire talk, conscious talk. I don't think that'll happen. But sometimes there's a reaction to two loose ways of speaking, and then sometimes to, so we have to look at the history of these, the context of all these ideas, including my own, because I'm coming, I'm very much coming from the point of view of an analytically trained philosopher of mind and who works in moral psychology, and for the last 10 years has worked in comparative ethics and moral psychology. So that's, okay, I'm supposed to stop quickly, but do I get one more from Teed Rockwell? Can I do that? Yes, of course.
Okay. When I hear all this stuff about, you know, one group of people saying, well, this must be a physical explanation, another group saying, well, this must not be a physical explanation, you know, I look at this, and to some degree, this is sort of like an issue of tribal territory. It would be kind of like if you had a group of people arguing about whether Bigfoot existed, and then somebody hauls one of these creatures in to a zoo, and somebody says, oh, well, this isn't really Bigfoot, this is actually just a recently discovered species of non-anthropoid North American primate, and therefore it isn't Bigfoot anymore. You know, and the feeling is, well, if we just describe this in a certain way, if we describe this process of luminosity or whatever with, you know, physics language or something like that, then it isn't, you know, then it isn't dualism anymore. And, you know, this is, I think both sides are making the same mistake here. If you try to look at something like this and you just say, is it physical or is it not physical, you're really just talking about territory. You know, is it part of my particular conceptual system or is it part of their particular conceptualism? Are my friends smarter than your friends? Now, you know, if you try to get beyond that, you know, if you look at Owen's answer to the example about the mammalian brain being the result of compassion, and he said, well, there are Darwinian explanations for that. But, you know, a question that you could take a look at this and say, well, is it a matter of, you know, the genes created these things through chance mutation and therefore these brain events happened? Or do you say, well, an individual proto-mammal started caring for its young, made that decision, and therefore the brain started developing in a certain way? When you ask the question that way, you really do get something that is different from pointing to one or the other, and that's something I don't think. Darwinians usually assume the answer is, oh, you know, it had to occur by chance mutation. A lot of other people would say, well, maybe it was the choice of this proto-mammal. And I think that both of those are compatible with the facts. They're metaphysical claims that go beyond the scientific facts.
Very helpful, and on that note, that's very helpful, and on that speech by my friend Teed, I think my sponsors have said we must stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Flanagan, and thank you for your great questions. We're running a bit late, but we're going to take a 5-minute break. Bathrooms are downstairs if you need them. Thank you.